The first 7 years of Deco Cigar's life were happy. Rural Somalia was beautiful. He had plenty of brothers, sisters, and friends to play with. The family farm provided what they needed. But then, war broke out. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Cigar's pleasant rural life was shattered by terrible violence and civil war. This hour, he'll share his experience of fleeing his home, growing up in a refugee camp, and finally immigrating to the United States. He's the author of Life in Exile, the untold story of civil war and refugee life. Then later in the hour, a Drake University project allows young immigrants and refugees to share their stories. We'll hear from them. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, refugee and immigrant stories. Later in the hour, we'll hear from three Des Moines high school students about what it was like to move to a new country, learn a new language, and start a new life. They were all part of the Drake University Community Research Summer Scholars Program. But first, Deco Cigar tells his story in the new book, Life in Exile, The Untold Story of Civil War and Refugee Life. He's from Somalia. He spent 16 years in a refugee camp in Kenya and moved to Des Moines in 2007. Since his arrival, he's pursued two graduate degrees and has worked hard to help other refugees. Today, he's employed by Lutheran Family Services based in Omaha in the Sioux City area. He's a program coordinator for 5,000 refugees and victims of human trafficking. And he is here with us today. Deco, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And I think one of the things that you communicate beautifully in your book is how lovely your childhood was before civil war in Somalia. And I think a lot of us here in the United States, when we think about life in African countries that are war-torn, we make a lot of assumptions about what life was like before the war. And we may not think that it was very nice, but you paint a really beautiful picture of your early years in Somalia. Can you tell me about it?
Well, thank you. I think in general, I guess there's a confusion between a refugee and immigrants. An immigrant has no choice. I mean, has a choice when it comes to migrating to another country, whether it is for education, economic opportunity, or any other factor. For refugees, there's no desire or a choice when it comes to a relocation. It is a matter of safety and a survival. For us, though, before the Civil War, life was extremely very beautiful. Growing up in a farm, we did not have like a satellite TV, iPads, internet, you know, all the fancy stuff that are available to kids in the Western world today. But we're very much contented with our life in the refugee camp. We had plenty of food. Life was extremely beautiful. We were
happy. This was on your family's farm?
Yes, and we were really happy to swim in a crocodile-infested river. So it was extremely beautiful. You know, life was very peaceful and prosperous.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
My parents were blessed with 12 kids, 5 boys and 7 girls. 3 died at early age due to, you know, preventable illness probably. But today we are 9, 3 boys and 6 girls.
When you were about 7 years old, that's when things started to change. Tell me what happened that made you understand that life was going to be very different.
Well, you know, it was a huge transition for me. When the Civil War happened, it came in a very gradual way to us because before the Civil War, people could not possess, ordinary citizens could not possess guns or pistols or any other kind of weapons. But we have witnessed just ordinary people with guns, militias. For me, though, I think the most, difficult scenario that I can remember is my introduction to the Civil War. Me and my siblings were coming from the farm and around noon. And we, you know, that's where we used to spend most of our evenings or mornings, just helping our parents with some of the chores. And then we usually came back to our house for lunch. And on our way, we found this huge gathering on the outskirts of the village, which was quite, you know, unusual to see that kind of gathering at that time of the day. This is the time you expect people to be really busy with their daily life. So we knew then, you know, something must have happened. And ordinarily, we only saw that kind of gathering during a funeral. But from our small knowledge, we knew no one has died in the village. So we were quite curious to find out what happened. And I remember running with my sisters towards the, you know, the crowd. And upon arrival, we have seen our mom among the crowd. She looked really extremely very distraught, shocked. But she wasn't crying. But there were a bunch of other women crying hysterically. And in the Somali culture, when you kind of see a group of women crying in a big gathering, it often symbolized death. So we knew then something bad must have happened. And in a few minutes or so, mom took us home. And on our way to our house, we bombarded her with questions. You know, mom, what happened? But she tried to kind of redirect the conversation and ignore our questions. But we were quite persistent, and eventually she shared the information with us that, you know, there were people that have been killed, and the people that have been killed were the brothers of a woman who lived next door to us that we always considered her as our aunt. So to me, I think that was the most horrific, you know, experience. And I remember later that evening, me and some other kids from the village, we went to the site of the incident. And that was extremely the most shocking.
You saw the blood.
Blood and human flesh and all that stuff. So for a child who have known only peace, prosperity, community, love, and to a level where people have been butchered, I could not reconcile the two.
What finally forced your family? Things kept happening. Your family wasn't involved in this civil war, but the militias were more and more present, and they would come and they would steal and they would kill, they would rape.
Mm-hmm.
What forced your family to leave your home?
So, you know, we thought, you know, Somalia was under military dictatorship for probably 20 years by that time. And I think there was a general feeling that, you know, there will be a change, the military leader will be overthrown, and life will go back to normal. And people had a hope, the hope that things will go back to normal eventually. But that never happened. So we fled from our village, kind of being internally displaced people, moving from one village to another, hoping that things eventually will resume to normal. And we spent almost a year and a half moving from within the country, trying to see if things will be okay again. But that never happened. And eventually, my dad decided to come back to the village.
To go home again.
Yeah, because he came to the conclusion that there was no safe refuge in Somalia, even though in that village we were considered to be like enemies. Because prior to the civil war, Somalis lived wherever they wished. But to my understanding, I came to know that is not where my ethnic community really were the majority. So we came back, and upon arrival, I think that is when the fateful day happened. And when we lost everything, then we had no other option but to seek refuge elsewhere.
To leave the country. And your father had a very strong ethic of giving to others. Your entire life. You write a lot about how he felt that even if he didn't have much to give, he should give something. One of the things that he would do and other members of the village would do when you were growing up is if there was a family with children and they didn't have much food, he would loan an animal to that family so they could milk it and drink the milk. And then they would eventually give that animal back. And your father had many animals. Yeah. That fateful day that you're talking about, your father was captured by a militia and tortured in front of you. And he was tortured by a man who was the child of someone he had given an animal to. So that man that tortured your father had actually been raised on the milk from your father's animal.
Yes, and I think that is quite interesting because it stays with me forever because my father had a such big heart, and same with my mom. I think they got themselves, like the satisfaction they need or their purpose in life was to support others. And I think that has kind of like became a contagious to, you know, for me, for my siblings. I think we still believe in the philosophy of giving others. I think
in spite of all you experienced and all that was taken from you.
Right. But for this specific guy, my dad don't even mention too much about it. He doesn't talk a lot about it. Even though this kid who was, you know, raised on the wealth of my dad had subjected him to such brutality, my dad never discuss that in detail. He never brings the issue, you know, like the whatever he gave to his dad when this young militia was a child. Because to some degree, he believes that talking about it is kind of like destroying the good deeds that he did.
Bragging.
Bragging about it. I had this from other people, and I tried to ask him about it, but he will just like, you know, shuggle and just ignore the whole conversation because one time he said, I think, and that's the only time that I had him comment about it, he said, no one really knows what human beings, you know, will end up doing. At that time, he was a child and a very vulnerable child, and I supported his dad. You know, it is very, very, to me, that lives with me forever because that kind of shows how humble and generous my dad is.
That day, you and others were actually able to free your father and the other men that were being tortured, and then you fled. And that's when you started your journey to Kenya.
Yes, that is the day we started our journey. And I think the most difficult part for us was we lost everything, but also like the small things like utensils, they took every single thing, not only money, animals. So they took everything. And by the time we left with one item, like one piece of cloth or so.
Wow.
For us, though, we felt like we will not survive.
It was a long journey, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Deko Sagar. He is the author of the new book, Life in Exile, The Untold Story of Civil War and Refugee Life. He's from Somalia, and he lives in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour is Deko Sagar. He tells his life story in the new book, Life in Exile, The Untold Story of Civil War and Refugee Life. He spent the first 7 years of his life living very peacefully and happily in rural Somalia. He took a very long journey to Kenya after civil war broke out. And Deko, there is so much that happened on your journey from your home village in Somalia to Kenya. But I encourage people to read your book to find out more about that. I want to talk about what happened when you reached Kenya, because there were, of course, many, many displaced persons who were seeking refuge in Kenya from Somalia. What was it like when you actually crossed the border and arrived?
So after long and excruciating journey, we made to Kenya Somali border, where we have been accepted and registered by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees as refugees. We came to the Dadaab refugee camp, which is the largest refugee camp the world has ever known. You know, in the early stages, the camp was designed to host 90,000 refugees. Today, I think it is a home for 500,000 people.
Wow.
So we came to the camp, and life was extremely very challenging. So it was like this open desert place dotted with tents, with no electricity, no running water, no latrines or toilets. People had to go to the bush to help themselves. And then people were dying in large numbers the first few years because the sanitation was extremely very poor. Hygiene was a huge issue. And I remember there was a family that lived next to us, and I think almost everybody died except three people, and that was a family of 11 or 12 people. And then the difficult part of the life in the refugee camp is that people live on donations. And then that is only basic food. So we got 2 kilograms of corn, a small amount of oil, for 15 days. And oftentimes people have to skip lunch or dinner and eat one meal a day to survive. Otherwise, if you run out of food, there's no additional or supplementary.
So even though you had made it to the refugee camp, the danger of starvation was still very real, and especially for people who were not yet registered as refugees.
Yes.
And your parents, again, had this very strong ethic of sharing what they did have.
Mm-hmm.
You write about a time when, as a boy, your mother asked you to share your breakfast with other children,
right,
who had not yet registered as refugees. And you had so little, but you had to sit at the table and share what you did have. And that day was hard for you. You rebelled a little bit that day. You said, why? Why do I have to give my food away?
Yeah. So I think, you know, as a kid or when resources are extremely very scarce, we tend to be a little bit selfish, right? Especially when you know how hungry your stomach is. And I remember coming from the madrasa to my tent, and my mom had this family who lived next door to us. There were three boys. Dad and mom died in the Civil War. So they have not registered with the United Nations, and they have a term for that. So those people who have not been registered yet, they call Bahane, which really means the hungry. So before you are being registered, and that can take a few months to a year, because the United Nations are very cautious about duplication of clients.
So they could be living in the refugee camp for a year without the services.
Exactly, because there's so much similarities in terms of name. You will find people who are very much the same birthday, like January 1st, 1980s, Muhammad Ali Muhammad. So for them to avoid duplication, they have this very strict vetting process of ensuring that people don't double register. So in that time waiting period, people, the new arrivals, have to rely on the goodwill of people like my mom and dad to help them get through. And my parent and many other families won't let that happen because it will be extremely challenging to let someone die of hunger when at least you can help them with one meal.
Right. You mentioned that you came back from the madrasa that morning. Now, let's talk about education in the refugee camp, because you spent 16 years of your life living in that refugee camp. Before you got there, you really had no education.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two kinds of education offered in the refugee camp. One was the religious education at the madrasa, learning the Quran,
mm-hmm.
and then there was also primary schooling, learning to read and write, and even to learn English, right?
Yeah. Yep. So for my dad, though, you know, in early stages, I think he kind of he wanted me to be an imam or a sheikh. So he predetermined what I will be doing in the future. But I had my own interest, and he took me to madrasa. So he wanted me to memorize the Quran, learn the interpretation, and, you know, I'm set. But I wanted to go to school at the same time because kids of my age were going to school in the morning, even though the school time is a little bit different from the one in the United States.
So it was mostly that you were bored because the other children that were
yes.
your age were,
yes.
were busy doing something else.
Yes.
But neither your mother nor your father, I mean, neither one knew how to read or write. It was
yep.
not something that they valued. So
no.
this was not something that they pushed.
Yes. So for them, they didn't understand the value of education. And I think for my dad, it was a little bit apprehensive because I was kind of like a goofy kid to begin with. So he thought maybe this is a gateway to, you know, like westernization or maybe even like converting to another faith. So he was a little bit very protective, I guess. And then when he told me you can go to school, I formed my own soccer team. And he wasn't fan of that either. So he will go through the refugee camp sometimes looking for me. And a few times he saw me playing between two, you know, blocks, and he will bring the whole game to a standstill and pull me out and take me back to the madrasa, even though no one is at the madrasa at that specific time.
So he didn't want you to go to school and he didn't want you playing soccer.
Yeah.
And when you finally started going to school, you actually hid it from
him. I did.
That was a secret.
So, like, I talked to my sister at the time. She lives in the refugee camp right now today in the DAP.
She's still there.
She's still there. So I talked to her about it, and I told her, look, I need to go to school. First of all, I really like the idea of learning another language and be able to write, you know, other alphabets, because I saw other kids writing non-Arabic alphabets. So that kind of interested me. And then she took me to school, and the agreement was that if I get in trouble, that I will not bring her name or drag her name into the business, right? So I told her, look, I will handle this, or I will take the punishment for it. So just help me with the registration. And she did. And surprisingly, school became my favorite things because I was really good at it. I was extremely good at the school, even though the education system was extremely very poor. The first time I became number 3 in my class, I was given some small reward, a crayon and a small book, notebook and a pencil. And I think that kind of got me. I like the attention that came with it. I like the praising. I like to be the cool kid or the smart kid in the class. And that's when everything changed for me.
Later on, now a number of people who live, obviously they spend their whole lives in this refugee camp. They marry, they raise children there. So many people get jobs to supplement the food, to supplement their income. And you got a job and you had to tell a small lie to get this job. You also had to work extremely hard and prepare yourself for the job. But you got a job with Doctors Without Borders. What were you doing for them?
So my first job was to a community health worker. So technically what we did was community education. We were trained for almost a year by the Doctors Without Borders. And our role was to be the bridge between the health practitioners and the community that we came from. For me, I was at the time 16 years old, and it wasn't ideal for Doctors Without Borders to hire someone of that age. But because
they wanted someone who was 18.
18 at least. So for them, you know, they wanted that. But for me, I lost all my documentation and IDs, and there was no way for them to verify my real age, right?
And your parents don't actually know your birthday.
No. So I came to this, I applied, and then I was extremely malnourished child. And I remember that day I had multiple clothes on to kind of look presentable to the interviewer.
You put on almost everything you own so that you
yeah.
would look bigger.
Yeah. And when I came to the hospital for the interview, the first question he asked was, how old are you? And I said, I'm old enough. And he laughed at me and he asked me the same question and I again. And I said, I'm old enough. And then he gave up. So we went to the interview and I was lucky enough to be hired by Doctors Without Borders. And that has really saved my life because I wouldn't be where I am today without opportunity.
You write so much about life in the refugee camp and you traveled so far to safety, and yet life is so precarious in the camp. There are still, rape is an incredibly common and terrible problem in the camp that can lead to, of course, so much if a woman is raped, especially if she conceives a child by her rapist. You also write about other acts of violence, the terrible illnesses. Working as a health worker, you saw such terrible things. Spending the night in a ward, you would see several children die every night.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fast forward a few years. When did you finally learn that you just might be able to qualify to move to another country?
So, you know, for a long time, our hope was to go back to Somalia. And the civil war in Somalia never subsided. It went forever. And eventually we came to the realization that there's no going back to Somalia. And growing up, you know, when you're young, you often, all you care is what you eat and where to sleep. But as you grow up and become a teenager, a young adult, your needs changes. And I wanted to pursue my dreams, and that wasn't possible in the refugee camp. Luckily, in 2005, we were invited by the United Nations to come for an interview. And that was a huge deal because we knew we had a strong case, but getting an opportunity, an interview opportunity with the United Nations where you are being considered for resettlement was quite very rare. So we went through that process, and eventually our case has been referred to the United States. In 2006, we had our first interview with the U.S. Department of State and Homeland Security. And eventually we went through the medical checkup and all that stuff. And in September of 2007, we were lucky enough to come to Des Moines.
So that was a two-year process from start to finish for you, or even a little bit more than 2 years.
Yeah.
And now, in today's climate, it's a much longer process, often 4 years mm-hmm. or longer, or just non-existent for many people who would like to make that same transition. You were so worried about making sure that this process went on successfully that you didn't want to change the family makeup at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that when you came to the United States, when you finally got your documents and were able to come here, you left your new wife,
mm-hmm.
who was also pregnant at the time, behind in the refugee camp.
Yes. You know, like, it is such a very complex process, and there's so many eligible people on the waiting list. And any inconsistent in your information will put you on hold forever. So for me and my wife at the time, it was extremely difficult to go back to the Homeland Security and tell them that, look, I got married and my wife is pregnant. First of all, they will tell me to wait until the child is born. And that means another 7 months or so.
Right.
And that, you know, we had these long, difficult conversations, and eventually we came to the conclusion that I had to go. So I was separated from my wife for almost 2 years, and she was able to join me in 2009. I haven't seen my firstborn until at the age of 1 year.
Wow.
I had to go back in 2009, the summer of 2009, to visit them in the refugee camp. And upon returning to the United States, they were given the green light to travel.
Now, of course, starting over in a place you had never heard of, Des Moines,
mm-hmm.
Iowa.
Yeah.
That wasn't easy either.
Yep.
And you have done so much with the opportunity that you were given, pursuing education, helping others. We only have a couple of minutes here, and we could spend all day talking about your experiences. But what do you want people right now in 2017 to understand about refugees and our refugee crisis, which has done nothing but grow since you were forced from your home? What do you want people in Iowa to know?
So I think this refugees are victims of circumstance, and these are not economic immigrants, but they come to this country with a great optimism and hope. I remember when we landed at Des Moines International Airport on September 13th, 2007, around 11 p.m., we were received by a case manager from Lutheran Social Services of Iowa. And I remember we drove through downtown to my apartment. And I was sitting at the back seat looking through the window. And I'm thinking in 5 years or so, I'm going to own one of these skyscrapers in downtown Des Moines. You know, that's not a reality for me right now. That's the kind of motivation and ambition people come to United States. These are people who have been denied opportunity for decades. Right now, I work with refugees who have spent in a refugee camp in Thailand for 30 years.
Wow.
And the general assumption, I think, oftentimes is that refugees are, you know, these people who want to suck the blood out of the system. Well, no one really wants a handout. People want to be self-sufficient and independent. But I think the best thing that we can do for refugees is acceptance. And that has not cost a lot. Because for me, I guess the major challenge I faced was loneliness. I was extremely lonely in the middle of hundreds of thousands of people surrounding me. I came to a country where I had no support system, no family members. I knew nobody. So I think acceptance is, I think, something that we can all do.
Well, Deco Sagar, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Deco Sagar is the author of Life in Exile, The Untold Story of Civil War and Refugee Life. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are many different circumstances that can lead an individual or a family to leave their homeland and immigrate to the United States. The experience of moving to a new country, learning a new language, and starting over brings with it tremendous challenges. Challenges that are hard to imagine if it's not part of your life experience. Then try to imagine making that transition as a teenager. A group called the Community Research Summer Scholars at Drake University this summer, 13 Des Moines area high school students, all of whom are refugees, along with a few Drake students and faculty members, put together podcasts that tell the stories of these students who immigrated to the United States. Excerpts from their interviews have been posted at SoundCloud.com. And I'm going to talk with some of the high school students who were involved in the project. But first, Darcy Vandegrift is a professor of sociology at Drake University and co-director of the Community Research Summer Scholars Program. Hello, Darcy.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
How did you identify the young people who would participate?
Well, we had some great contacts in the community. The participants were in English language learning programs in Des Moines Public Schools. Others were part of after-school programs for recently arrived students or for Latino youth. And so by reaching out to contacts in the community, we had an application process, and every scholar that participated in the program wrote an essay to apply, and then we selected from it was a competitive process that we selected the scholars.
Well, Darcy, stay with us. Again, Darcy Vandegrift, professor of sociology at Drake University. We'll come back to you in a little while, but I want to turn to some of the students who are involved in this project. First, Tam Cao is a junior at Hoover High School. Her family came to the United States from Vietnam about 2 years ago. Hello, Tam.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. Why did you want to be involved in this project?
I want to involve in this project because I want all the people to know about my stories, about my experiences when I got here, so they can understand how hard for me when I came here.
listening to your story, you shared a couple of different stories, but that are included in the podcasts. You talked about how it felt like you were being thrown into deep water and people were just standing around and watching you as you struggled, watching you drown in this deep water. It must have been so hard for you when you first started school here. Did it feel like you were completely alone?
Yeah, I was really alone because nobody helped me at all, and I didn't know anyone at school. So, yeah.
Did you, with the other students, it was hard to connect because you didn't share the language. Did you feel like your teachers helped you?
Yeah, my teacher helping me a lot. Like, I can communicate with people in English right now that it, because of them, they helped me. They helped me. They taught me English, and they helped me like whenever that I needed.
It sounds like from your story that you have worked so hard to learn, but also so hard to connect with the other people around you. Do you feel like you have friends now at school?
Yeah, I have a lot of friends at my school right now because I joined some club at school. So I kind of like have a lot of friends right now.
What do you want people who are listening to this today, what do you want them to know about what it's like to be a newcomer in the United States, to start over like you had to do and not speak the language? What do you want people to know?
I want them to know that like I have a really hard life when I came here. I didn't know English. I didn't know anyone. So I really like want them to understand my feeling, like what I have been through.
In your podcast, you talked about how what your personality was like in Vietnam and how you had to hide so much of yourself when you came to the United States because you didn't have friends and you didn't speak the language. Do you feel like you can be yourself now?
Yeah, I can be myself now because I tried to like change it, like who I was before. Because like in the podcast, I say that when I was in Vietnam, I was really like funny and crazy. But when I came here, people around me make me become a quiet person. Because I didn't speak English, and then people like make me become a quiet. Because they did not talk to me, they didn't want to be friends with me. So I feel really alone and lost, and at that time I was really stressful. And then I tried to join some club at school, and then like it helped me to open it my heart again, and then I become who I was before.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that you feel that way. And I'm sure it's been a long 2 years, but you certainly have learned a lot in only 2 years.
Yeah.
Tam Cao, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. Tam Cao is a junior at Hoover High School. Her family came to the United States from Vietnam, and she's been here for about 2 years. Rita Idris is also, she's a junior in high school. She's at Roosevelt, and her family came to the United States from Sudan in 2015. Hello, Rita.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, you were just listening to Tam talk about her experience and how lonely she felt when she came to the United States and started school. How about you? What was it like for you when you first got here?
It's basically the same thing because, like, I didn't speak English and I didn't know anybody to help me except the teacher helped me a lot to make friends, and I joined some clubs, Shine, and other clubs that helped me to make new friends. And be participated with others and open my heart to to be friend with others.
In the podcast, you share your feeling about being able to get an education, that an education, especially for girls, was not something that was guaranteed for girls, adolescent, teenage girls in Sudan. So in coming to the United States, were you excited because you knew that you would get an opportunity to stay in school and learn?
Yeah. I was so happy when I came here because, like, I didn't stay in my country and, like, get married when I was young and have kids. And I came here, now I'm in school, and I want to keep going and then go to college and have a better education.
What do you think you want to do in college?
I want to study nursing.
Oh, that's wonderful. And what do you think you learned from participating in the Summer Scholars Program, where you got to be part of these interviews and also interview fellow students?
Yeah, because I get to meet new peoples, and I heard a lot of stories that they're similar to my story, and people who been through the same challenges that I've been through, and we got the opportunity to share our stories.
So it felt good to know that you weren't alone. Did it also feel good to be able to tell people what you've been through?
Yeah.
Do you feel like the students at your school understand what you've had to go through?
I don't think they will understand. But like, so if refugee people who like been through some challenges like me, they'll understand how hard it is for someone, for immigrant, to come here and meet new people and learn new language.
Well, and again, you have learned so much in only 2 years. I'm sure that you will learn a great deal more in the next few years and as you go on to study nursing. But Rita, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Rita Idris is a junior at Roosevelt High School, and her family came to the United States from Sudan just 2 years ago. My next guest is Gideon Mesfin. He's a senior at Waukee High School. His family came to the United States from Eritrea. Hello, Gideon.
Hello.
Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here.
You came to the United States in 2014. And so you've been here about a year longer than the girls I was just talking to. But take us back to 2014. What was it like for you when you just arrived?
It was kind of the same thing with the time and Rita said. But like the one thing, like the first time I came to the United States, I came to South Carolina. And it was hard because like our expectation was high. Because like when you was in your country, all you think about is like you come to the United States and you get a lot of things, good things such as money and school. So like when you come here, you don't get these things, which is like, especially if you're a teenager, you don't get no money. I mean, family can get money from the agencies or some places, but like you don't get no money. You just go to school, and then after you go to school, it's kind of hard to get to know people, and you don't even speak English, and then you got different language, you got different cultures. So everything is different, which is, it's a little frustrated.
Yeah. Well, and even being in a place where you know you're safe and there is assistance with getting enough food to eat, I know that that, of course, can be very powerful, but still you have so many challenges to face. Tell me, how big is your family?
We were six, a family of six, which is my mom, and I have four little brother, and I have one big brother, which is, he was living in Israel. He just came to the United States a year ago.
So when you came, were you the oldest?
Yeah, I was the oldest, but I had my uncle, which is, he's older than me, 2 years older.
So as the oldest child in the family, did you feel like you had a lot of responsibility to help your mom adjust to living in a new country?
Yeah, I still do. I mean, yeah, because like if you're the oldest one, like you were the one who does everything, which is especially in my family. My dad doesn't live here. He lives in Africa. So I was the oldest one, and then I have to do everything, which is like what's the dads do, which is, you know, yeah, that's what I felt.
And you, of course, have learned English. Is that something that you had to learn or to help your mother with as well? Because young people do tend to learn faster than those of us who are a little bit older.
Yeah, my mom doesn't speak English. So it was a good thing for me to be learning English, which is so. And I just started driving, which is 2 years ago, right after I get here. And I had to take all my family to appointments, which is because I was the oldest one. And then I was the, like, yeah, when I was the oldest one, so I have to take them to everywhere they have an appointment and translate by the, like, the English skill I have.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was.
So you're a student, but you're also in some ways like a dad because you're taking care of your brothers and sisters and taking them where they need to go and making sure they get the care they need.
Yeah, you can say that.
You shared a story in the podcast about getting a promotion at work, which congratulations on that. But tell me a little bit more about that story, because, of course, not only are you a student and a big brother and help your mom, but you also have to earn money for the family.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell me about your job.
It's like the 2 years I've been here, I didn't work because, like I told you, my brother was in Israel. So he sent money to my mom and she bought a car. So I had to take her to family, which is to take my appointment and go to school. So it was a lot of job at home. And after 2 years, I started working at the Price Chopper. It was at the big store. And after a month or 2 months, my manager told me to, he wanted to move me to the gas station, which is because I was doing good at the big store, so he told me I can do it at the gas station. So he moved me there. And then after, he told me I was going to get a raise in 6 months. But, like, after I worked 2 months, he gave me raise. And he told me he was going to teach me how to be a manager. But the saddest thing, the boss, he transferred to other Price Chopper. So, yeah, that was the story of it.
Right.
And, yeah.
So it was a good experience. It sounds like you learned a lot, but now there's a new challenge.
Yep.
Your voice is one that we hear a lot in the podcasts, not just in telling your story, but it sounds like you did a lot of interviewing, a lot of asking questions of the other students. Was that something you really enjoyed doing?
Oh, yeah, because it's always good to hear something that is similar to your story. So you know there is a lot of people who's been to a lot of struggles like you've been. So it's a good thing.
Gideon Messman, thank you.
Yep.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Gideon Messman is a senior at Waukee High School, originally from Eritrea. And Darcy, I'll return to you as we wind up. These interviews have been recorded. The students clearly worked very hard on asking each other questions and on editing the audio. What do you hope happens next?
Well, we're hoping to spend the next year disseminating the podcast and creating a study guide and a curriculum so that teachers and community organizations refugee and immigrant communities themselves can listen to the podcast as a way to reflect on the experiences of talented young people in our community and to learn more about the refugee experience, but also the experience of what it's like to be a teenager in Des Moines, because I think that these stories are powerful in that way as well. So we're hoping to share them in a number of different venues. And of course, they're available for anyone to look up at the SoundCloud CRISP site as well.
Well, Darcy Vandegrift, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Darcy Vandegrift is a professor of sociology at Drake University, also co-director of the Community Research Summer Scholars Program. And you can find a link to the podcasts put together by the Summer Scholars on our Facebook page and on our website, iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.